The Progressive Commentary Hour with Gary Null, Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Gary Null, you're listening to the Progressive Radio Hour. Each week, I share commentaries from people who I have a great deal of respect for. Today, in the second part of our program, Chris Hedges, who interviewed Jeremiah Wright, will talk about what it means to be a vilified, scandalized man thrown under the bus by someone that he spent decades nurturing. You'll hear that commentary. Also today, I'm going to be opening our calls early on in the program and asking you to call in when I share my points of view about the lies we are told about the safety vaccines. A commentary is actually a letter, open letter to Dr. Miriam Burton, president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, from Leslie Botha, a short letter about the safety of the Gardasil vaccine. You're going to hear in a moment an interview of a doctor whose own child was injured, brain injury, autism spectrum disorder injury, and was awarded millions upon millions of dollars. And she says that there are over 88 other families she's personally aware of who have met. They all received multi-million dollar settlements, but were warned, keep it quiet. It's got to be secret by the federal government. Now, this is the same federal government that has told us repeatedly that there is no connection between any vaccine at all or combination of vaccines and anything appearing on the autism spectrum disorder scale, from ADD to Asperger syndrome, because autism is not one condition. It's a spectrum. Yet all of them, every single one of them, receive money totaling several hundred million dollars cumulatively when all their children had autism diagnosed and were compensated by the federal government for it. The government has been pathologically lying to the American public. We're going to let you hear from her in this very important five-minute interview. And then I will read a letter following that, then I'll ask you to call in.
A group of families who have children with autism are set to announce the results of a major investigation tomorrow. The group saying the federal government has paid out multi-million dollar settlements to dozens of families whose kids suffered brain damage after receiving vaccines. Dr. Sarah Bridges is one of those parents. Dr. Bridges, thanks so much for coming in. We know that you have this groundbreaking announcement to make with dozens of other parents tomorrow. And basically it is that you accepted payment from the government after your child developed autism following childhood vaccines. What led you to believe that it was the vaccine that caused your son's autism?
Well, in the case of my son, in some ways we were lucky. It was very stark what happened. He had been developing well until he was about 4 months old, ahead of his milestones, everything else. Went in for the well baby checkup, got a spate of shots, and that night awoke us with a high-pitched scream, was unconscious when we found him, 106 fever, and then went into a two-hour seizure that they had to finally get him so sedated that he stopped breathing, you know, reviving, going on the whole bit to stop the seizure. That was the demarcation to the point where all of the disabilities started unfolding, and autism was one of them.
And what is so fascinating about what you'll be announcing tomorrow and what you and the other parents say, the federal government has always said that there is no connection between vaccines and autism, though they did have a multi-million dollar payment to one little girl, Hannah Poling. And they said that her case was so unique because she had an underlying mitochondrial condition that did cause autism, but that would never happen again and that was very unique. Yet you are living proof that, in fact, they have been paying other parents. How much has your settlement been?
Our settlement has been millions of dollars. And the way that they do it is there's a lump sum for the child. It's not something the parents ever have access to. It is then paid out in an annuity where they figure out the exact life cost for the child over a lifetime. However, let me tell you that, you know, as you're figuring this out, they say helpful things like, but a lot of the kids don't live to be very old with this disability. They figure it right down to the diaper, and it's paid out yearly. So as the government was saying all these things, it was very baffling to me as the parent of a child that the government, out of the other side of their mouth, was saying, yes, your child is disabled, he has autism, he has mental retardation and seizures, and we're going to pay for his care.
And see, because the government has never allowed for this connection, and in fact, they've been quite clear to say that there are no studies that connect autism with vaccines, this in some ways smacks of a cover-up. Were you ever told to keep quiet about this settlement?
Very routinely. We had a lawyer who did these kind of cases regularly and talked about how dicey it was to have a topic like autism come up. And even subsequent to winning the case, and I say winning in quotes, you know, if the winning came at the expense of a marriage breaking up, of the other kids going through severe stress, and of my son finally being placed in a home because he needs round-the-clock care. So winning is
relative, yes.
But even after that, I was told, you know, this is an annuity. This is something he's not given his money for life. Be careful talking about this. Your best just to, you know, feel lucky you've won this case. And to be quite honest, not knowing other parents, you have no access to anybody. I had no idea how prevalent this was.
And so yet tomorrow, you and dozens of other families are taking the bold step, even though you had been told to be quiet because the money could dry up for care, you are taking the bold step of coming out and making what announcement?
Making an announcement that the idea that there's no link between vaccines and autism is a complete red herring. My child was compensated in 2001. There are dozens of other cases like this. And, you know, we know from something like statistics, as soon as we have one exception to what we're saying unequivocally, it's not true. This is not true. You know, certainly there's a risk in parents speaking up. Some aren't comfortable doing that. But frankly, being one of the lucky ones, I feel a real obligation to do that.
And I know that you also want to make the point that you are not anti-vaccine, nor are these other parents. You just want the information to get out there that there is a risk to vaccines.
There's a risk to vaccines. I'm assuming that we'll find out, like so many things, that there's an interaction between genetics and a very few number of people and the vaccines. I'm very pro-vaccine program. I understand public good, that there's often a few that suffer in the context of that. My problem is not taking care of the children that have been the casualties of this. To me, that is completely immoral. And that's where the victimization happened to me, not in the fact that we were unfortunate to be one of the few that was injured.
Keep in mind that this is a physician telling you that she's received millions of dollars, was told to keep this quiet, was not told that there were dozens of other parents who also have been given millions of dollars to treat their child, to keep it quiet. They all suffer from autism. Once and for all, this puts the lie to the statement there's no connection between vaccines and autism. The government has known this all along. Now, this is a letter from Eileen Daneman, doing terrific work as director of the National Coalition of Organized Women. And this letter, a short letter, is to Dr. O. Marion Burton, president of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Keep in mind, the American Academy of Pediatrics has been pro-vaccine for decades. Dear Dr. Burton, on behalf of the thousands of parents who have either lost their perfectly healthy teenage daughters or been left to endure the physical, mental, emotional, and financial hardships of being forced to deal with the permanent disabling effects of Gardasil vaccine, we are offended by the thoughtless, ignorant, and offensive press release issued from your office, the American Academy of Pediatrics, on September 13, 2011. The press release criticized the comments made by Republican presidential candidate Michelle Bachmann regarding Gardasil side effects as, quote, false statements, and instead stated authoritatively, quote, it, Gardasil, has an excellent safety record, unquote. Are you still practicing pediatrics? Physicians in the United States look at the American Academy of Pediatrics for guidelines, yet the American Academy of Pediatrics seems to be oblivious to the latest vaccine adverse event reporting systems. Statistics clearly showing that human papillomavirus vaccine Gardasil and Cervarix have been associated with 22,619 adverse reactions, 8,926 of those reports requiring emergency hospitalizations, 4,616 cases where the victim did not recover. Deaths reported stand at 102. According to the National Vaccine Information Center, these figures reflect 1 to 10% of vaccine-injured population reporting. The rate of anaphylaxis in young women post-human papillomavirus Gardasil vaccination has been found to be significantly higher by 20-fold than those identified in comparable school-based vaccination programs. In fact, out of the 76 vaccines approved by the FDA, the human papillomavirus makes up 24% of the adverse injuries being reported. The American Academy of Pediatrics is responsible for the health and welfare of our children. The Academy's ignorance and arrogance of vaccine injuries is deplorable and unacceptable. Instead of showing compassion to victims and their families and making attempts to clarify or further investigate the possible causes of all these unexplained side effects, you simply dismiss them all by stating, quote, there's absolutely no scientific validity to this statement, unquote. This letter is to inform you that we have recently informed the FDA the Gardasil vaccine currently on the market has been found to be contaminated with residual recombinant human papilloma DNA. This hitherto unknown contaminant may have provided a scientific basis for Gardasil-induced autoimmune-based inflammatory disease in various tissues, including inflammation in the joints and central nervous system. If the American Academy of Pediatrics is interested in this subject, perhaps using it as part of your continuous medical education materials in place of those distributed by Merck, please read the hyperlink below. Now, just to give you an idea, the Merck gave the American Academy of Pediatrics $433,000 as a contribution. I might mention also what this means in lay language is that virtually every girl now in the United States or around the world receiving the Gardasil vaccine could be exposed to the Gardasil live virus, meaning the human papilloma live virus, therefore putting her at risk of developing human papillomavirus or cancer because of it. And they have swept it under the rug, and now everyone's covering their behinds. Your thoughts, please. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'm also video streaming. You can watch this program. We had a little trouble, and we're figuring we'll video stream half of it, and then we have technicians fixing it at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Here is the second part of the issue that I want to get really in front of people. I hear individuals say, Gary, how is it that the banks got away with this, and it's all legal? These people who have the capacity to spend enormous amounts of money, take very big risks, lose, and we bail them out when we're not helped by anyone. No one's helping our daughters and sons with their student loans. No one's helping us with our usurious rates on credit cards. No one's stopping our homes from being foreclosed on or cars from being repossessed. We're getting kicked in the teeth. How did this happen? So from Roger Knight, an op-ed news, a lesson in history, one that's important. You've heard me on this program mention many times that we should immediately lobby our legislators to reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act. In the absence of reinstating that, nothing will change. You'll have more lost jobs, more jobs sent overseas, and more penalties for us. Outside of agriculture, which has been experiencing an economic depression since the end of World War I, the American economy during the 1920s was robust and vibrant, and it seemed as though it would grow forever. The country had experienced an unprecedented industrial expansion starting with the Civil War, and the demands for manufactured goods, and the technology to produce those goods on a grand scale. The war had caused that. That expansion had continued through World War I and into the Roaring Twenties. So great was the faith of the American economy that as late as 1928, Herbert Hoover remarked in his acceptance speech at the Republican Convention, quote, "We in America today are nearer to the final triumph over poverty than ever before in the history of any land. The poorhouse is vanishing from amongst us," unquote. You think he was wrong? Well, the 20s roared because people had money to spend, a compulsion to buy, an enthusiastic but intemperate faith in the future. People had money to spend because the industrialists shared this unrestrained but ultimately insane belief that prosperity would not only last forever, but that it would expand forever. Profits were indeed high, and business, in anticipation of ever greater rewards, reinvested in new factories, creating new jobs, and the new jobs created new spending. In the industrialized East, at least, the future could not have looked brighter. And this would be the mentality, and it was on display in the stock market. Almost nowhere would it eventually prove to be more destructive. The tumultuous economy of the 1920s would find its antithesis in the dark years of the 1930s, and hard lessons to be learned, only to be forgotten in the 1990s. Even today, there isn't a total consensus on what actually triggered the Great Depression. But there is agreement that it resulted from the confluence of a number of events, the stock market crash ranking high on the list. If a single word had to be chosen to define the cause of the Great Depression, it would be speculation in industry, in banking, in land, in the stock market. Another word that fits is regulation. More specifically, the lack of it. And a third, excess. Discussing the contribution of all these to the Great Depression and the legislation that followed would be well beyond the scope of my discussion right now. In the 1920s, common wisdom held that the stock market anticipated the needs of making and selling goods and would correct itself as demand changed. It's that old favorite laissez-faire economics, and when mixed with a toxic dose of trickle-down foolishness, it becomes the bedrock Republican dogma. Inexplicably, it's still common wisdom in some camps today, despite having been proven to be just plain wrong at the end of the 1920s and again in 2007 and 8. By 1927, what Herbert Hoover would call an orgy of mad speculation had taken control of the market. Everyone wanted in, and the price, and therefore, was low, and it was perceived worth buying the stock, and the stock would soar out of any proportion to the goods the stock represented. And this would happen over and over again, everybody predicted. As early as 1925, some were beginning to realize that mass production needed to be constantly fueled by mass consumption. After all, you can't produce something if someone's not going to use it. So you produce it, people will buy it. And that, in absence of any rapidly expanding population or export market, growth at the rate that then being realized couldn't be sustained. Unfortunately, neither of those existed at the time. Immigration had been severely curtailed by the Johnson-Reed Act, officially the Immigration Act 1924. Post-World War I, Europe was broke and Asia had not yet become a player in the world trade. With no regulation to restrain the market, were those chasing the pot of gold they believed to be found there, a number of questionable, sometimes downright shady, unethical, illegal, corrupt lending and investment practices arose. Leading the field in the questionable and highly destructive categories was the practice of making call loans, loans to be used specifically for the purchase of stock. These transactions were known as call loans because rather than being amortized, the lender could call for them to be repaid in full at any time. As is true with many things that become corrupted, call loans didn't start out being bad for America. They just started out flawed. The first problem with them was that since it was anticipated the loan would be repaid from the profit realized when the stock increased in value, actual collateralization of the loans was pretty iffy, or not at all. Some loans were secured at as little as 10% of their purchase price, with few being secured at no more than 50. Such was the faith in a concept that even a modicum of reflection should have called this all into question. The second problem was that without regulation, there was no restraint on who could issue call loans. It wasn't long before banks and brokerages were handing them out to pretty much anybody who wanted one. Even large corporations started issuing call loans to be used only to purchase the corporation stock, stocks some were reissuing with staggering regularity. The third problem was that obviously the lender was most likely to call the loan in early if the value of the stock fell or to or below the amount loaned. As those loans proliferated, a tremendous amount of unsecured debt was being accrued. Unsecured debt that would eventually help bring down the stock market. When the bubble started to burst, cash-strapped banks began calling in loans, only to find that investors had no cash, and investors trying to sell learned that the stock had little or no value. The end of the good times didn't happen all at once. It happened in starts and stops and lurches, but it did inevitably happen with a preordained certitude. There was just no avoiding it. Following a period of intermittent market instability, in late October, the house of cards came crashing down with an ominous finality on Black Thursday, October 24, 1929. If any of this sounds eerily familiar, that's because it should. We would see the modern equivalent of its rebirth in the late 1990s, and the result of that birth is 2007-2008. Now, bear in mind that I'm only showing you a very small part of a very large picture. A number of other events were also taking place at about the same time, and events that would also help bring America to its economic knees and define life as a great many Americans during the Depression years. The bank panic in 1930, the dust storms that fell upon already struggling farmers and devastated the Midwest in between 1930 and 1936, to name just a few, each played their role to some degree. After the excess of the 1920s and the damage done in part by the irresponsible banking and investment practices, it was clear that new rules were needed to protect the middle class. Some of those new rules came in the form of the Glass-Steagall Act. It was named after its author, Senator Carter Glass, Democrat from Virginia, and Congressman Henry Steagall, Democrat of Alabama. So when we speak of the Glass-Steagall, we're usually thinking of the second Glass-Steagall legislation. The first, officially known as the Banking Act of 1933, sort of emergency legislation limited to expanding the powers of the Federal Reserve and was intended to control runaway inflation. The second Glass-Steagall Act established the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC, and imposed a number of restrictions on banking practices. Both were intended to protect the middle-class investors and savers from the excesses and abuses of the 1920s that had cost so many their jobs and their savings and their dignity and their future. Well, the Glass-Steagall Act imposed four new restraints on a financial industry that had proven itself incapable of restraining itself. First, commercial banks were prohibited from engaging in investment activities. That's a good thing. That is to say, commercial banks could no longer risk your money and in your savings account investing in schemes in which the investor's money lost it, and they couldn't do that. Second, investment banks could no longer act as a commercial bank, the flip side of the first provision. Next, no Federal Reserve member bank could affiliate itself with any bank primarily involved in investment activities. And finally, no individual could serve in an official capacity for a commercial bank and an investment bank at the same time. That'd be conflict of interest. So for all those decades, the American public was protected. We didn't have casino capitalism. But all that changed when Bill Clinton, Alan Greenspan, Phil Graham, Lawrence Summers, Timothy Geithner, and Robert Rubin, Secretary of the Treasury, all got together and practicing the Ayn Rand two-step and objectivism, they all got together and they decided we don't need this, and so they got rid of it. And because they got rid of it, then the banks could do anything they want with any amount of money they want. They could borrow all they want. They had low interest or no interest rates, and they did so. So in came a credit default swap. It's a derivative because it's a somewhat like an insurance policy taken out on a loan, and typically its value is tied to whether the loan is repaid. And these credit default swaps are very harmful. They are toxic. Right now, I've estimated there's $500 trillion worth of credit default swaps out there. That's what they gambled on. So today we need the Glass-Steagall Act back. We need protection back, and we need it back now. So I'm asking you, the American public, reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act stop derivative trading and stop trading in anything essential to life: water, gas, oil, food, and currencies. If we can do that, and we can reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act, then we can also tax all of these overnight trades and computerized trades at 5%, have one flat income tax of 20%, that no deductions are allowed, eliminate the Federal Reserve, and eliminate the IRS, then we will have prosperity again. More on an upcoming program on other ways to create jobs, but at least that would give us an enormous amount of protection. And the politicians won't dare touch this. That's why we have to remind them. We're aware of what you did, how you did it, and the scheme that the corporate Democrats got away with. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Let's begin with remembering back to the debates. Do you remember how Obama was bashed and trashed by people on the right because of his affiliations, one of them being with Reverend Jeremiah Wright? Obama's politically expedient decision to betray and abandon his pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, exposed his cowardice and moral bankruptcy. In that moment, playing the part of Judas, he surrendered the last shreds of his integrity. He became nothing more than a pawn of power, or as Cornel West says, a black mascot for Wall Street. Obama, once the glitter of power fades, will have to grapple with the fact that he was a traitor not only to his pastor, the man who married him and Michelle, who baptized his children and kept him spiritually and morally grounded, but to himself. Wright retains what is most precious in life and what Obama has squandered, his soul. The health of a nation is measured by how it treats its prophets. When these prophets are ignored and reviled, when they become figures of ridicule, when they are labeled by the chattering classes and the power elites as fools, then there's no check left or moral decay and the degeneration of the state. Wright, who spent 36 years at the Trinity United Church of Christ on Chicago's South Side, since the 2008 presidential campaign, has endured slander and weathered character assassination, misrepresentation, and abuse, and yet he has doggedly continued Sunday after Sunday to thunder the Word of God from pulpits across the country. I grew up a Christian. My father was a pastor. I graduated from a seminary. I can distinguish a Christian pastor from a slick imposter and charlatan, from T.D. Jakes to Joe Osteen. Wright preaches the radical and unsettling message of the Christian gospel. He calls us to live a moral life. He knows that the measure of our lives as individuals and as a nation is reflected in how we treat our most vulnerable. He knows on whose side he stands. Obama, who like Judas took his 30 pieces of silver and betrayed someone who loved him, withers into moral insignificance in Wright's presence. Obama, although his subservience to the war machine and Wall Street mocks the fundamental values of Dr. Martin Luther King, will preside October 16th over the dedication of the Martin Luther King Memorial on the Mall in Washington. He will lend himself to the venal cabal of the corporate and political elites who have hijacked King's image. These political and corporate figures, many of whom donated significant sums to build the $120 million memorial, for example, General Motors gave $10 million, uses the memorial in a commercial for its vehicles, seek to silence King's demand for economic justice and an end to racism and militarism. King's vision is grotesquely deformed in Obama's hands. To hear the voice of King, we will have to turn from the choreographed and corporate-sponsored dedication ceremony to heed the words of a handful of men and women who are as reviled by the power brokers as Martin Luther King was in his own life, and yet who battle to keep the flame of King's message alive. I think it's a wonderful thing that the country would recognize someone as important as King, Wright said when I reached him by phone in Chicago, and recognize him in a way that raises his likeness in the mall along with presidents. He's not a president like Abraham Lincoln or George Washington, but to have him ranked among them in terms of this nation's paying attention to the importance of his work, that's a good thing. I read Maya Angelou, who I interviewed on my radio program years ago when she wrote I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, about the way the quote was put on the monument. Wright said in referring to the editing of a quote by King on the north face of the 30-foot-tall granite statue. The inscription, quote, reads, I was a drum major for justice, peace, and righteousness. But these are not Martin Luther King's words. They are paraphrased from a sermon he gave in which he said, If you want to say that I was a drum major, say that I was a drum major for justice. Say that I was a drum major for peace. I was a drum major for righteousness, and all the other shallow things will not matter. Angelou said, the mangled inscription made King sound arrogant. I read the explanation as to why we couldn't include the whole quote, said Wright, who helped raise $200,000 for the monument. Kids 100 years from now, like our pastor was born 3 years after King was killed, they're going to see that and they'll not get the context. They will not hear the whole speech, and that will be their takeaway, which is not a good thing. My bigger problems, however, have to do with all the emphasis on 1963 and I Have a Dream. They have swept under the rug the radical justice message that Martin Luther King ended his career repeating over and over and over again, starting with the media coverage of April 4, 1967, a time to break silence message at the Riverside Church in New York City. Martin Luther King had a huge emphasis on capitalism, militarism, and racism, the three giant-headed reptile. There is no mention of that, no mention of that Martin Luther King, and absolutely no mention of the importance of his work for the poor. After all, he's at the garage collector's strike in Memphis, Tennessee, when he is assassinated. The whole emphasis on the poor sent him to Memphis. But that gets swept away. It bothers me that we think more about a monument than a movement. He made a movement trying to address poverty. It was for jobs, not I Had a Dream, not black and white together. But that gets lost. You look at older people that were alive during that time. I'm saying, wait a minute. You're missing something. You're missing something, and my grandson, well, my youngest one is 11. He'll not know that Martin Luther King. I'll tell him, but what's going to happen in terms of the curriculum? What's going to happen in terms of schools? What's going to happen in terms of the millions of visitors to go to Washington, D.C.? They will miss that Martin Luther King entirely. We have an idealistic portrait. I think that does violence to what the man stood for and what he was trying to do. More ominously, Wright warns, the sanitizing of Martin Luther King has been accompanied by the primacy of a selfish, hedonistic, and violent culture, which has turned away from values, including self-sacrifice, that make possible harmony and the common good. This selfishness, narcissism, is a form of blasphemy. Wright said to me, We got so focused in on being number one, on being the superpower. When the Cold War ends, we reign supreme. Empire, corporate interests, business interests take over. We got so focused on that and the media hype, the media, of course, being owned by the corporations, that the founding principles, the core principles that I feel should have been our guiding principles in terms of becoming what King called the beloved community and becoming what Howard Thurman called the search for common ground, got completely lost. We substituted the prayer of Jesus with the prayers of Jezebel, increasing my territory, enlarging my territory. If you notice, Jesus taught us to pray, and I speak as a Christian minister. I realize that the country is not all Christian, but just in terms of the principles that I believe cut across interfaith lines and boundaries is in the prayer. The model prayer the Lord taught us as the Lord disciples has no first person singular pronoun. It's our, we, us that got lost. We became a me-focused kind of dog-eat-dog, Ayn Rand, social Darwinist, survival of the fittest, be strong and no more care, no concern, no compassion for those that are not born above the scratch line, and no concern to make the communities in which they live, in the world in which they have a community which really cares about all of God's children, regardless of their colors and regardless of their faith. Unquote. Jeremiah Wright has become something of an expert on the commercial media since he was psychologically lynched by them. The media selecting clips to tar him have plastered him for demagoguery and shut his voice out of the national discourse. He has, like all other of our greatest intellectual and moral dissenters, from Ralph Nader to Noam Chomsky, been rendered a pariah. The media became interested in profits and selling airtime and selling newspapers and selling magazines and selling if it bleeds, it leads, whatever will get us a larger market share of the audience, of the viewing audience, of the listening audience. That became the focus rather than sharing factual news with Americans and the world in terms of what's really going on. That's no longer important. What's important is, above all else, profit. Once that media spun narrative is out there, from that point on, all you hear is critiques of the narrative, deconstruction of the narrative, debates concerning the narrative, affirmations of the narrative, attacks on the narrative, with nobody talking about substance, because we don't even know what substance is. Jeremiah Wright insists that the church, especially the liberal church, that allied itself with the civil rights movement, is alive, although ignored and unheeded, as a voice within the larger society. He says, the average church in America has 200 members, but they get no news coverage. The news covers the mega churches, Rick Warren. We're talking big churches, large memberships, but men and women who are in the trenches, who have not bowed to Baalah, the 7,000 more than God told Elijah that God had, are ignored. They're still there. They're still doing it. They are not, perhaps, and this is spoken from a 70-year-old man, and I would say 50 years of that as an adult looking back, as numerous as they were back in the 1960s. There are fewer and less vocal in number, but they remain. The problem is the media is not going to put out what guys like your dad and my dad were doing and saying Sunday after Sunday, not just in worship, but throughout the week as they tried to make ministry meaningful after the benediction. That doesn't get covered. I see them still doing it, still trying to do what they did back in the 1960s, but not getting the media coverage at all. Let them marry a gay guy or a gay couple. That's going to make the news. Let them go up against Walmart, especially Walmart's treatment of women or its workers. That doesn't make the news. Because the Waltons and the corporate giants who control the news don't see that kind of work by the church as important. What's important is that the Supreme Court sided with the Walton family so that those churches that are trying, that are dealing with poverty, that are dealing with honest conversations about educational reform, that are not jumping on the waiting for Superman bandwagon or Bill Gates, but who are really in the schools, are relegated to the shadows. And from what I see talking to local pastors, they're trying their best to make a difference in the lives of the poor. They're doing the feeding. I just left Fresno, and a little small church out there adopted one of the missions for the needy in Fresno. They've got a place called Tent City in one of the richest counties in the country. Folks are living in tents as if it were Calcutta. The guys from the small church in Fresno are going there because it's dangerous for the women to go over there. Guys are going over there once a week, and they're taking the youth of this church. But that's not making news. I've seen the church doing all kinds of exciting things around the country, but it's below the media radar. How many times has there been a debt ceiling vote these past few years? 87 times. But what became news? Well, first of all, don't mention the number of debt ceiling votes to the public. The media needs a crisis, whether it's the debt ceiling vote or Obamacare. These are the things we keep in front of the people's faces. What about the important issues? If it's about the defense budget, or the fact that major corporations have not paid a penny in taxes, we get, no, don't put that in front of them. It's low information America. It's my mind is made up, don't confuse me with any facts America. I see what the church is really doing. The liberal church, the old line church, the unpopular churches, the ones that don't get the coverage. I see them in the trenches 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. We don't know what successful ministry is. When you change and touch the lives of people, when you make a difference in their lives, when you give them hope, when you help them go back to school and get an education, that's successful ministry. But even seminarians I teach are looking at ministry like it's a, well, be like Mike basketball role model that are pursuing. Instead of important and life-changing questions being addressed, the question one hears are, how many members do we have? How many CDs and DVDs have we produced? How much money do we make? That's not a successful ministry. Too many seminary students aren't interested in making things better. They're interested in becoming like T.D. Jakes, the building a mega church. They're not interested in being in the hood with those who have lost hope. We don't want our children to have any kind of critical thinking. We just want them to be able to function in a low-paying, dead-end job. There's no emphasis on teaching the young African-American male to dream and teach him and the young sisters also, him or her, that, okay, education is more than passing scores. How you perform on a test, it has to do with how you live in a community with others. It has to do with nutrition. It has to do with poverty. It has to do with the whole person. We are slashing and burning programs at the preschool level. We start with Head Start and an early education in childhood and all the way up through the foundational primary grades. Who is going to teach these kids Langston Hughes' poem, Mother to Son? Who's going to repeat Hughes' words to them? No one. Who's going to tell them that you can do this, you really can, you can achieve? You are not what society has labeled you. And then we have to give them an alternative, some tools where they can get a job, where they can take care of their families, where they can learn to think critically and analyze some of the stuff that they're hearing on television and deconstruct some of the stuff they're hearing in hip-hop. Because there are so many conscious hip-hop artists who have not bought into the corporate model, but you need to know the difference and be able to tell the difference between the two. That kind of engagement is what I know several churches are doing. Jeremiah Wright, who perhaps knows Obama better than any other person in the country except his wife, sees a man who sold his principles for the chimera and illusion of power. But once Obama achieved power, he became a tool, its vassal, its public face, its brand. Wright told me, President Obama was selected before he was elected, and he is accountable to those who selected him. Why do you think Wall Street got the break? Why do you think the big three financial institutions were bailed out? Those were the ones who selected him. We didn't select him. We don't have enough money to select anybody. We're accountable to those who select you. All politicians are. Given those constraints, he is doing the best he can because he is accountable to the ones that put him where he is. Preachers, pastors, ministers, we are not accountable to those people. I'll never forget one of the most powerful things he said to me in my home, second Saturday in April 2008. He said, "You know what your problem is?" I said, "What is that?" He said, "You have to tell the truth." I said, "That's a good problem. That's a good problem." When he was elected to the United States Senate, I was asked what advice I would have for Senator Obama. I said, "Please don't change who you are because of where you are." Who he was before he got into that position is very different than the Barack Obama you see today, which to me is unfortunate because it's to be expected, because that's what you choose. You choose to run, to be in that place. I can give you a glimpse into the kind of person he was, which was mind-blowing to see, to me, to see somebody with that kind of integrity. He went to his first Congressional Black Caucus meeting the year before he announced that he was running for the Senate. He came back to Chicago and came into my office asking for an appointment. He was heartbroken. He showed to me that night his naivety and his integrity. He was naive because he was down in Washington trying to get an audience with the Congressional Black Caucus in terms of testing the waters about his making a run for U.S. Senate. And it was a meat market that blew his mind. I'm saying, Barack, come on, man. Name one significant thing that has come out of any Congressional Black Caucus. Come on. He was naive. He told me, "My name should be out there right now, last week in September, but I can't announce." "Why can't you announce?" I said. He said, "I don't know whether or not Carol Moseley Braun is going to run again. I will not run against an African-American woman." And I'm saying to myself, what manner of man is this? I know guys who would run against their own mama. He will not run against an African-American female? To have that kind of integrity was awesome to me. But he changed, and that's unfortunate. In February of 2007, on a broadcast of Religion and Ethics, I said there will come a time when Obama will have to distance himself from me. Now that's February 2007, so the fact that he had to distance himself from me does not come as a surprise. What did come as a surprise was how he did it. I've heard you describe that your dad laid the foundation upon which you stand. He made you the kind of person you are. I know that when you interview somebody and the tears start, you fold up your notepad and put your pen away because you're not that kind of reporter. If there was somebody from your dad's church running for an office and the media comes up to them and puts a microphone in their face and says, "Did you hear what Pastor Hedges was saying about the war?" If you disagree, your response is, "I disagree with that. Next question." You don't have to chastise Pastor Hedges. "I just disagreed with him." Next question. But Obama was listening to people who are politically minded. People are counting votes. He was not listening to people with integrity. In November, December 2008, during the ethnic cleansing of Gaza, one of the news media persons put a microphone in front of Barack's face and asked him, "What do you think about what's going on in Gaza?" He said, "We can't have but one president at a time." I told my wife he needed to be on Dancing with the Stars, the way he danced around that question. That was like a preview of coming attractions in terms of a pragmatist, center of the road, conciliatory, not speaking from principle, as the world needs. And for him to have a community organizer in one of the poorest communities in the city, and a housing project, and now to be painted into a corner where he can't address health care for the poor. He took the public option off the table. What happened? What happened is politics happened. Martin Luther King would be saying to us the same thing today he was saying in 1966, 1967, 1968. He would be condemning our nation's utter disregard for the poor. A strong nation cares about all of its citizens, regardless of their color or their race or their religious beliefs. Malcolm X, once he broke with the Nation of Islam and found that God and or Allah really doesn't have children that don't look like you, would be appalled by our buying into a military option as a way to peace, as a way to finding common ground. The military option is not an option. Martin Luther King and Malcolm X would agree with that. In conclusion, I was walking through the airport a few weeks ago. I saw on the cover, I think, of Time magazine, Osama bin Laden's picture. The caption on the cover said, "Justice." I said, "How about murder?" It was an assassin's hit. What really bothered me, as I read more, was that it was Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and the war folk who were sitting in the war room watching the hit. There were cameras in the field. It was a hit, two right above the eyebrow. Why did you murder that man? We have international courts of justice. We have trials like the Nuremberg trials. Why did you murder him? Why not put him up on trial? And I sat up in the middle of the night, about 10 days later, with the answer. I said, because you didn't want him to talk. If he starts talking on the stand, everything comes unraveled. We will have to look at the Cheney war machine. A trial would rip to shreds the lies we have been telling ourselves and our American public. We can't afford that. So we must murder him. We murder him and call it justice. That one really hurt. I said to myself, this is the Barack you once knew, who cared enough about humankind to work in the gardens with the poor, to not run against an African-American female, who now calls for professional Navy SEAL assassination, a hit, and watches it. It's like that story you heard your dad preach, and you know from seminary in Acts, where the demons said to the seven sons, "Jesus I know and Paul I know, but who are you? Who have you become?" End quote. From Jeremiah Wright and Chris Hedges, I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all very much for listening.